Okay, go ahead and explain that, if you will, further.
Okay, you can't have the two systems can't be conflicting. Two systems are not conflicting. If the Sanhedrin rules that the man is innocent, then the king can't just go off and kill him. The case was tried, and he was ruled innocent. But the king has a right to intervene before the Sanhedrin gets the case, and he has a right to say, this case is coming under my jurisdiction. All right? So that's the way it works. But they're not conflicting. You know, the key conflict can't have one system saying he's innocent and another system saying he's guilty. That's impossible. But the jurisdiction of the Sanhedrin is determined by the king. In other words, the king can say, look, there's lawlessness now in the country, and we have to try these people. And even though they may be, they may be able to get around the law, the technicalities of the law, we know they're guilty, and we have to do what's necessary. Okay, that's the way it works. So, and that's the concept. If you look in Isaiah 11, that's exactly what he when he talks about the King Messiah. He praises the King Messiah. He will be the ultimate. He represents the ultimate. King judge that will judge justly, fairly, and will take care of the society, and of course it affects the entire world. He's going to take care of the entire world, that the world should be in a state where there is justice and never a state of lawlessness. That's the problem, by the way, with as everybody knows, the problem with American law. In spite of the fact that it's supposed to be so practical, it turns out that it's many times impractical, and you see killers go loose because the system, even though they are not bound, as I said before, the American legal system is not bound by any kind of logical internal structure. It could be illogical, but that's the law in the books, and that's it. They're geared more towards the practical. But nevertheless, we see the flagrant injustices that take place because man is really... Man is not capable of establishing a perfect law, even a nearly perfect law. But the King Messiah will be one that will establish the most nearly perfect law that is possible with his wisdom, with his great wisdom. And of course, it doesn't mean only he's not going to be the only one that judges. He will set up a system of others under him that will judge as well and do what is necessary in order to bring lawfulness to the world. And then, once the people are in the state where they're receptive to law, then we bring in the technicalities of the technical laws, because that's really the technical laws are the most perfectly structured laws. So we try to minimize as much as we can the law of the king, even though he's a just king. We try to get people to be so law abiding that we don't have to move in to fill in those gaps, so to speak. We hope that when people are on a very high level, there won't be that many gaps, and won't be necessary for the king to move in. But of course, he's always there, and he always has to be on beam. But his function is determined. How much he functions is determined by the society. Okay. So all right. So now what we're going to do is we're going after the seven laws, and.
Okay, what I want to do is to make the point that in our previous studies that we were taught by other rabbis in the entry level of this B'nai Noach teaching, we're talking several years ago, and a number of people that received those tapes received these tapes. And we were taught at that time, we were not taught this depth, let me put it this way, the depth that we're receiving now, that the Ben Noach received capital punishment regardless of what happened. And regardless of any of the violations of the seven universal laws. And see, it was not explained in the depth that you are, and I think we need to amplify here that the rabbis, when in the inception,
right,
were teaching what they knew.
Right.
And that this is not a contradiction.
No.
You're not contradicting them, nor are they in contradiction with you, that they merely related the information that they possessed at the time.
Yourself to one aspect, which is correct, but the...
Go ahead.
...thing... thing is that they didn't introduce the other component. So there is no contradiction between the laws that they stated and between what we're stating here tonight. They were simply relegating themselves to one part of the picture. And I believe referring to Rabbi Katz, I have a lot of respect for the man, and I believe that he was accurate, no doubt, within that framework, if I'm getting what you're saying right. Except that he didn't go into the other framework, which we're discussing tonight. And by the way, I mean, this is something which is very common, as I told you. That's why I related to you that incident, that story, because many people in yeshiva, you know, they study the tractate Sanhedrin, and they didn't study the area about the king, you know, so they will only discuss the technically structured laws, and there are different components to the picture. The Talmud is a very, very broad. The Torah is very intricate, elaborate, and all-inclusive. And first you study an area, you know that area. But you have to realize that there are other parts still missing to the puzzle. And to see the whole picture, of course, requires that's what a truly great scholar is. That's like a Rabbi Feinstein or a Rabbi Soloveitchik. He's a man that knows the details of every single component, plus he knows the whole picture. So that's that's a very high level of scholarship, and it's something which is very rare. The important thing is that if a rabbi teaches, he's not expected to have that level of scholarship. Otherwise, nobody would be qualified to teach. So a rabbi, when he teaches, he is qualified in what he is, that part of the puzzle that he is explaining, he will explain accurately. But you have to realize that, you know, that's not the entire picture. But you can't expect every individual to be to have the whole picture. Otherwise, you wouldn't have that many teachers. Mathematics, I mean, the great mathematicians have an overview of the entire field of mathematics. But if you're studying algebra, so you're just studying algebra. But there are many things that you're studying geometry, you're studying Euclidean geometry. There are many things that were introduced later in projective geometry, which really should precede ordinarily geometry. So when you study later, you'll see, hey, this stuff I studied before, really I should have viewed from a different standpoint. But that's what knowledge is. You know, that's the way knowledge is in every field, and the same thing applies to Torah. If you're studying one area, you have to realize that there are other components that could change the entire picture of what you're studying now, although what you're studying is correct, given the framework that you're in. So we can't expect anyone to do more than that, than to teach the framework that they're in. And many times, a question comes to me that's outside the framework. When I'm giving a class in Talmud, I say, fellas, let me look into this, and I'll get back to you tomorrow. So I have to do research, you know what I mean? The important thing is to try at least to present accurately that which you are presenting, to try for a total picture, at that point. Okay, let me get back to to what we are doing. And now we're getting to the seven laws. Now, I would only make one preface, and that is that it's something which other people who embrace the Bible, religions that embrace the Bible, like Christianity, for instance, always had a difficulty. They could never really understand the laws of the Bible. For instance, Leviticus. Now, Leviticus is filled with laws, and that's why basically other religions just threw out those laws, because they don't know how to handle them. You can't understand them unless you have a systematic approach, and the only systematic approach is the one that the Talmud has, and nobody else, you know, if you're going to just start taking these verses and making them whatever you feel, I mean, you're going to come up with thousands of opinions, and it's impossible to understand. The point I'm trying to make is this, that the Torah consists of two systems ordinarily as well. There's a system of perfection and philosophy, and then there is the technically structured laws, which are very carefully constructed, and very logical. You need both, because, you see, many people are impressed with the philosophy of Torah. Love your neighbor. Sounds like a great thing, wonderful thing to do. They might not understand what it means, really, in depth. It doesn't mean what it sounds like on the surface, actually. But it's something which people are enthralled by. Oh, that's great. We'll take that one. But you have to realize that the God system of perfection is a little deeper than that. You can't just grab what sounds good and just abandon the rest of the texts of the five books of Moses. That doesn't make any sense. So what you have to understand is that the five books of Moses, the Torah, really has two systems simultaneously. There is, and as a matter of fact, they break down in a basic way to what the Talmud refers to as the written law and the oral law. The written law is, even though a lot of the written law, you know, when I say that, you have to understand that a lot of the written law is also a very important in the oral law, but usually not. The area of sacrifices, for instance, there's the area of sacrifices. Read Leviticus, says it has a lot of the is there. Whereas when you come to Sabbath, it just says don't do any work, and the whole structure of what work means is outside. It's completely oral. Okay, it's completely in the Talmud. But there's a reason for that also. Why the Torah sometimes incorporates in the written law things that you would think ordinarily would belong in the systematic structures of the law. But basically, the oral law is a reference to the systematic structures, the intricate structures of the law, and the written law usually is the philosophy and the ideas of the Torah. And that's why the Torah is written in a very strange way, because basically the Torah is written, God wrote the Torah in a way that the semantics have to satisfy two systems simultaneously. So you have to know how to unravel the semantics. Just to give you a brief example, for instance, it states in Leviticus that the priest is not permitted to scar himself. Okay. Now we know that's not just the law for a priest, for a Kohen, it's a law for every Jew, and previously it mentions the law, and it doesn't mention the priest. But the reason why the Torah mentioned the priest is here the Torah is trying to satisfy the philosophical, because the priests of the ancient priests, that was part of their ritual practice, was to mutilate their bodies at certain events. That was part of the religion, part of the ceremoniousness. We even see that today. So the priests would usually be involved in this. So the Torah mentions the priests because it wants to show you that if the priests do that, then the whole system's defiled. So there the Torah is speaking philosophically. So the Torah is satisfying the semantics of the philosophical. And then also, when you read the interpretation of the oral law, you'll find that it's not just the priest, and the reason why it's mentioned is to add another detail to the law. But you have to remember, when you read the Torah, it's written on two levels. It's written on the philosophy, the ideas of perfection, and it's also written on the technical, structured way. Now, the world has some, if you just read the Bible, you get some idea of the philosophical, although probably not an accurate one, because that too requires an in-depth reading, which most people are not capable of. But some kind of idea you'll get of perfection. But when it comes to the laws, most people just abandon it because they just couldn't make heads or tails out of it. But you have to understand that God's system is very, very, very much, very heavy into the laws. Even the prophets mentioned the importance of keeping the laws in Deuteronomy. Anyone that reads Deuteronomy knows immediately that the significance of keeping the laws. The reason is because the God system is a twofold system. A God system is one that demands a certain rigid structure and also philosophy. Philosophy alone is not enough. You have to have the rigid structure. I would say it's similar to the human body. You need the rigid bones to in order to have a human being that's capable of bearing weights, and you must have the structure, and then you have the flesh, the soft part, which is compliant. You see, so you need both. That's the same concept in Torah. You must have the rigid structure, and you must also have the philosophical, which, as a matter of fact, the Torah leaves soft. It leaves it to the individual, because you can't legislate real perfection in man. Perfection in man is something which a person has to get to, and it's very individual. But the structure of the law is extremely important in order that the human being should be prone, should be brought to the point where he's capable of perfection. So it's a twofold system. There's the rigid structure, and then there is the perfection, which is left for the individual. But what we are going to study in the seven laws is the rigid structure. Okay, so I want you just to keep that in mind. And in the rigid structure, as I mentioned before, everything must be internally consistent, logical, and there's no room here for just arbitrary philosophy. That's not the nature of Talmud. That's why most people look at Talmud, they're looking for philosophy, they get confused. But we'll see as we go along. I think that these points will become more and more clear. Okay, so what we're doing is we're starting off with the tractate of Sanhedrin, and we're speaking of page 56A on the bottom of the page. Now, you can get this translation if you wish, and I know there's one in the manual, and it would be helpful if you would just read through at least before the class would be the best time to do it. Just to read through and take a look at some of the footnotes, explain a little bit, just to get an idea of what's going on, and then we'll, when we study it together, we'll analyze it a little deeper, and I think you'll appreciate it more if you look through everything first. I would look through at least till 57A. You get into 57A at least a quarter of the page. And then I think you'll have enough information. And you'll probably read certain things that will just sound astounding to you, which is good, because then when we analyze it and we study it, you'll appreciate it more. It's important. It says in Psalms, Psalms 1, it speaks about the perfect, and in his Torah does he meditate day and night. Meditate is a bad word, really. Meditate sounds like something from an Indian philosophy. But it doesn't really mean meditate. It means thinks. In his Torah does he think day and night. Think and work is implied by that word. So he works and thinks in his Torah day and night. Now, the question is, of course, the rabbis are very sensitive to the semantics. Why does it say his Torah he thinks day and night? What do you mean his Torah? Torah belongs to everybody. It should say, and in the Torah he thinks day and night. Rabbis explain, no, that little change, that possessive, is there for a reason. It's to teach you an idea that the Torah likes very much a person should be, when he's learning, it should be his own. You're not listening to a lecture. It should be your ideas. You may receive the idea from somebody else, but it has to be yours. How does somebody else's idea become yours? The answer is very simple. If you're bothered by the problem, then the answer is yours. If you're not concerned about the problem, it's not yours. That's somebody else's problem. You see, so it's extremely important when learning Torah to start the process yourself. And I often say, Rabbi Soloveitchik, who was one of the greatest scholars in the world, probably the greatest when it came to theoretics, he was extremely creative, and mainly he'd say, of course, his own interpretations, which were just beautiful. But he would often quote his grandfather, who was really an innovator in Talmudic thought, to which he followed that whole system of his grandfather. But there was always a difference between when Rabbi Soloveitchik would say over something from his grandfather, or when I heard another rabbi quoting Rabbi Soloveitchik's grandfather. Rabbi Soloveitchik's grandfather was world famous, so his book, people always quoting him. The difference was that when Rabbi Soloveitchik would quote him, he wasn't quoting somebody else. It was his own Torah. He was there. It could be, certainly his grandfather was the one that may have come up with it, but Rabbi Soloveitchik wasn't parroting over something. It was his own Torah. He was there. The question was bothering him, and he saw the solution. And that really is what Torah is all about. Studying Torah is not listening to a lecture. The world today, the academic world today, the collegiate world, has no concept of what Torah learning is. And in my opinion, it's they're lacking the whole concept of learning in general. But in the Talmudic idea of learning is not listening to a lecture, it's not taking notes, it's not repeating facts. It is an involvement, an engagement of the mind on an individual level. And therefore, if a person just sits back and takes notes like a college course, he may pass tests, but the purpose of the Torah is not to pass a test. The purpose of the Torah is to have knowledge that's related to your personality. That's your Torah. So, therefore, I say it's a very good idea to read through the Talmud before, even if you don't understand it, even if it makes no sense to you whatsoever. That's good, because then you're going to have problems, and if you have problems, they're going to be your problems. So then when we come across, hopefully when we come across the solutions, it'll be a solution as well. Okay, and maybe you'll even come up with a solution. So, not just the teacher comes up with solutions. That was a story in the Bible with Moses and the daughters of Tzelophehad, if you remember. They raised a question about inheritance. Moses didn't know the answer. They had their solution, and Moses went to God, and what did God say? Yes, correct. The daughters of Tzelophehad are speaking correctly. So you see that the great Moses, who was the great teacher, he was wrong in this case, and the daughters of Tzelophehad were right. So in the Torah, there's no ranks. It's not a system of ranks. You could be the greatest scholar, but you can have an oversight, and someone who is far less learned than you are can come up with the right solution. So Torah, in that sense, Torah is very democratic. Therefore, you need to put your minds to it as well. All right. Introduction, let us begin what the Talmud states. Talmud Elias. The rabbis have stated, now the Talmud states what their comment was. And this is the comment, quote, seven laws were commanded to the sons of Noah, all right? One of them, first one is courts, legal system. They must have a legal system. This make sure it has a legal system. Second one is blasphemy. The order is not important. Third one is idolatry. Fourth one is sexual prohibitions. The fifth one is the law against murder. And murder is the right word, not against killing. And people that translate the Bible and say, thou shalt not kill, it's an inaccurate translation because it's not true, because the Sanhedrin, openly in the Bible, God said to kill the violator. The one who violated the Sabbath, Moses received the commandment of how to kill him. And we just studied, if you remember last winter, that God stated that the death penalty is the proper penalty for blasphemy. It wasn't known. Moses didn't know. So thou shalt not kill is inaccurate. Thou shalt not murder. Murder is an act of an individual in a society against his neighbor. But when a court, when a legal system executes somebody, it's not murder. They're not doing it because of their own individual reasons. They're doing it in order to instill justice. It's an act of the court. That's not called murder, although it may be called killing. And I think Christians always misunderstood that commandment when they interpret it, translate it as "thou shalt not kill." I one time mentioned it, and I was correct, but I happen to know the Hebrew. The Hebrew is murder. Harog would mean kill. That's two different words in Hebrew. Based upon that, the Christians have often introduced a kind of clemency, and where the Torah really does not maintain that clemency is justified. Sometimes the death penalty is necessary, and not to impose the death penalty is to allow people that are lawless to run the society and to destroy the entire society. I mean, the Bible mentions openly when it comes to murder, do not accept any bribery, and if you do that, you're going to destroy the land. And as Nachmanides brilliantly states, he says, destroys a society. And that's what the Torah is, that's what the Bible is against. The compassion is a wonderful, wonderful trait, the most wonderful trait, but it must be guided by intelligence, and if it's not, compassion of fools, and you will simply destroy the entire society. So over here when we say this case, it means murder is prohibited, not killing. Killing is taking a life. Sometimes that's necessary. Okay, next one, next one is theft. And then we have the law of the prohibition against eating the limb of an animal that was taken from the animal during its lifetime. Now, this doesn't mean simply that you're not allowed to go over to an animal and remove a limb. It's more than that. Even if the animal lost the limb itself during its lifetime, you are not permitted to eat that limb. Okay, that is the law. Now, again, over here, we're getting into, here's where we have to differentiate between philosophy and between halacha. Philosophically, you can give reasons, you can say kindness to animals, whatever you like, but that plays no role to the rigid structure of halacha. The structure of halacha is that go back to Moses at Sinai, and philosophy is nice, it's good, it's necessary even, but it doesn't determine the law. The structure of the law is very, very exact. And the structure of this law is not simply cruelty, because if an animal lost a limb by itself, on its own, during its lifetime, it would be prohibited from eating that limb. You would certainly be prohibited from eating a limb if you ripped it off and, you know, during its lifetime, but that would be, in halacha, they would both be equal, whereas one would be a vicious act and more can
we have 1 minute.
Okay, so even though one would be more condemnable, but nevertheless, in terms of the violation of eating, they're both equal. That is the structure of the law. Structure of the law is not to eat a lust removed from an animal by whatever means during its lifetime. Okay, the philosophy and the structure of the law are not, and this is important, they are not commensurate. They are not it's a different kind of a system, because halacha has to be logically structured, and philosophy is not logically structured. It's not structured. It's a concept. So don't be upset if the case of the law may be more inclusive than the reason for the law. That doesn't matter. That's because of the fact that you must have a structure to the law. And this is the structure that the law takes. Why it takes this structure rather than another structure, that, as we will be able to discover that, and that's an area of discovery on its own, but in a very special way, as we will go along, we'll see how that works. You have to drop philosophy. Okay, we're